So, archaeology. I think all of you have some idea what we mean by archaeology, of course. The name archaeology, of course, that logi at the end, is related to the word logic, the story of. And the first part, of course, of archaeology is of what is archaic. It's the story of the past, of ancient times. And that means that it's fairly, in a way, a little bit synonymous with history. And that's why I've lumped together tonight to the topics of archaeology and history, to the extent that we can do justice with them. And the importance for archaeology, of course, is that it is our basic and in many respects almost our only source of information of the biblical world outside of the Bible itself. If it wouldn't be for archaeology and what it's turned up, we would, today know almost nothing except what is written in the Bible itself. As you know, at some points the Bible is fairly complete in its stories, and one could, get along without it. Other times the Bible is tantalizingly fragmentary. It didn't serve the Holy Spirit's purpose to tell us a lot of other things that we might be interested in, or it could take things for granted for the immediate audience that can no longer be taken for granted today, and so on. And of course that's the way it was until about 200 years ago when archaeology first really got going. But in the last 200 years, of course, that's changed drastically, but there are still tremendous gaps. And it's one of those things sometimes when one answer is questioned, why that raises six other questions that sometimes you're not sure whether you're making progress or not. I think one of the first things I want to stress, though, is that particularly when we talk about archaeology in a seminary or in relation to the Bible, that we have to stress that that's really only a small part of the whole picture, because archaeology really began more from secular motives outside of the church without reference to the Bible than it did from within the church with the concern to answer biblical questions. And that's still largely the case. It began mostly by people who were just interested in man's past, in man's history. I mean, some of them were Christians too, but the real motives were not, in and of themselves to explain the Bible or understand the Bible better. But of course, Bible believers were not slow to catch on as to what value there was in this type of study. And so, of course, there always has been a large amount of archaeological work that has been particularly motivated by Bible concerns in one way or another. And naturally, for people who teach Bible or in the church or wherever, that's the part of it that gets the most attention. But one should not lose sight, of course, of a much broader picture than that. And that's still true of most archaeology today, that most of the work that goes on is funded by universities. That's where the money is. A good share of it is no more profound than that. They just have much more money in their various departments, relatively speaking, than the church has for that type of thing. And there are some people who don't even want to talk about biblical archaeology, because they're afraid that doesn't sound scientific or something. And there have been just enough people who thought that if you had religious interests, that justified all kinds of other nonsense. And a few charlatans once in a while who were just out to make a fast buck, that of course give a bad name then to many others. There have been just enough of that, to those kind of things, to sometimes give biblical archaeology a bad name, at least for people who, sort of want it to have a bad name to begin with. So many people want to talk about Palestinian archaeology or Near Eastern archaeology. And you can see the logic of that, because naturally most of what concerns the Bible is related to, that part of the world where most of the Bible took place. Or if you cast a little wider net, then, of course, to Egypt or Mesopotamia. And the truth of that, of course, is that to the extent that archaeology is a science, that, you know, it's something like talking about, you know, Lutheran chemistry or, you know, Lutheran bridge builders or something like that, you know, really, that he's a Lutheran or a Christian is as such not the chief thing you're concerned about right there, as long as he knows his job, as long as he knows how to build a bridge that won't fall down when you drive over it. And with archaeology that he knows, you know, how to go about it, there is, you know, that part of truth in that emphasis. And to a certain extent, that's true all over the world. I don't know whether any of you have looked into much of the archaeological investigation that goes on in our own back door, particularly across the river here, the Indian remains that are there, Cahokia Mound State Park there, and of course Campsville now, where excavations are going on just up the river here, a few miles, and of course really all the way up the Mississippi Valley, where the Indian settlements. Or Mexico, of course, if you have had the occasion to go down there and look at the fantastic pyramids of the Indian cultures, you know, essentially, you have to tailor it to the problems of each site, each place. There are minor variations, but essentially, archaeology is archaeology is archaeology, no matter where it is. I think one other misunderstanding that has to be corrected, that is in a lot of people's minds, is that archaeology is basically a sort of a treasure hunt. And, you know, when you pass around slingshots and silver seals and that kind of thing, as you normally do when you're talking about it, that easily can reinforce that kind of misunderstanding. That is the way archaeology sort of got started. Rich people who wanted nice things to talk about when they had company, you know, to put on their shelves in their parlor. Or museums, of course, who wanted something, you know, to fill up their shelves in their museums and the like. That was a good share of it initially. And in the old imperialistic days, you know, when Western countries who had the money, you know, could go and carry all that stuff back, and the people who lived there, you know, had nothing to say about it, well, of course, they got by with that very easily. And that still lingers. Anyone who's been on an archaeology dig, when tourists come in and traipse around, why, nearly always the questions that they'll ask is, what are you looking for? And, of course, after you've heard that question the 50th time, why, you just, you know, throw a little dirt at them. Show them what you're looking for, or when you come back, what did you find? You know, well, whatever you did find, you probably couldn't bring it back with you, except for, you know, just a few things like that. You know, basically, you're looking for knowledge. You don't know what you're going to find, and of course, there's a danger. If you're looking too hard for something, then there's a danger, you know, that your imagination kind of runs away with you, and you think you find something, but then that has happened too. But that, of course, isn't right either. But I think increasingly, for people who, you know, are in on it at all, why the word is getting around, that this is simply a search for knowledge in a way like research in physics or chemistry. You don't know what you'll turn up, and you don't know what use it'll have. You cross those bridges, of course, after you have it. One other thing that should be stressed that is different generally about Palestine and the Near East is that archaeologists had hardly anything left above the ground. And I think when we think of archaeology, we think of course, what you see on the tourist posters, like the pyramids in Egypt or, of course, in Mexico, where basically they didn't have to do much except clear them, you know, get rid of a few weeds and a little restoration. Or the beautiful temples of Rome and Greece, of course, you've all seen pictures of those. But in Palestine, hardly anything was left like that above the ground, virtually nothing. And so all these nice things that you can take pictures of and pretty slides of, that type of thing is almost totally absent in Palestine. Very little was left standing above the ground, so that means nearly all of it is buried underneath the ground. And what do you find then when you dig it up? You know, you find stuff like that. And of course, when you first find it, it's all dirty. If you wash it, you're not even sure what you have. And you find stubs of walls. You find really just the lower courses of the foundations of city walls or the walls of buildings that never were above the ground, you know, even when buildings were on top of them. Usually what happened when there was a war or a fire or whatever it was, why, before they rebuilt, why, they would, you know, just level it off, if essentially like, you know, one does today, or if you raise the slums and build something else, you just level it off enough so that, you know, it's even and you can start building something on top of that. And, you know, that's not great exciting stuff. To the specialist, to the scientist, that may be very exciting. But in terms of pretty pictures and slides and all that, well, you know, that's not terribly interesting. One other correction, if I may, that I think should be stressed is a common statement that you hear that archaeology proves the Bible true. And, well, you know, that's one of those half-truths, and I think one has to be careful with. There is a large measure of truth there, with a lot of liberals who, you know, sort of don't want the Bible to be true and are inclined to assume that the Bible is guilty till proved innocent, you know, that the Bible is not true until you prove it true. And the list is long, of course, where the critics were skeptical that such and such a man, you know, never lived or nothing like this ever happened, that time and again, of course, archaeology has proved beyond the shadow of a doubt, you know, that at least there was a man like that, or that at least this could have happened. Sometimes you can't carry it further than that. So there is a fair amount of truth in that, and some of that is still going on. But I think that there's another side to it, too. It's a little bit like what I said before. Often with these subjects, when you get an answer to one question, it opens up other questions. So sometimes it looks like you make one step forward and two or three backward occasionally. And there have been a lot of times when archaeology has thrown curves at us too, or at least initially it doesn't give, you know, the Bible believer the answer that you'd want to find. Now, we are quite sure that that's just because of the fragmentary information that we've gotten. And sometimes after you learn more, then that initial difficulty clears up. But often initially, and some of these, you know, are still stand, some of the major problems here come with Joshua's conquest of Palestine and fitting this all in. How this happened, the Jericho, you know, that from what we know, Jericho doesn't appear to at best have been a very big or a very strong city, you know, when we think Joshua should have been there. Now, there are problems with dating, too, and you know, correlating dates. Ai, you know, the next one that you may recall that they attacked after Joshua fell, the very name means ruin. It sounds like a funny name for a self-respecting city to begin with. Chambers of commerce don't usually name their cities the ruin. And it was a ruin at that time, at least what we think with AI. Now, you know, there are all kinds of possible answers, you know, that this wasn't the same place or, you know, a different date. You know, I don't want to go into that as such here. But just as an illustration of that, one should not overstate his case. Certainly archaeology has, time and again, you know, solve problems for us and stop the mouth of the skeptics. But there is the other side too, that at least in honesty, one just has to be aware of and just wait and see, you know, how that's all going to work out. And I think there's a little question with this word proof too. You know, even on the historical level, to finally prove something, you know, I like to use an example of John Kennedy's assassination, where that almost went on, you know, in front of the television screens of all of America. And yet, you know, there are still doubts, you know, about whether this was a conspiracy or just one nut, you know, or just actually what went on there. You know, if we can't prove, you know, decisively something like that, you know, just imagine how hard it is to really prove, you know, beyond all shadow of a doubt, something that happened, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago and 9,000-10,000 miles away. So, you know, one has to use that word proof with a little caution. And above all, you know, even if or when archaeology can prove that the event happened or something like that, I think that the danger of careless talk about the Bible, about archaeology proving the Bible true, is that it can never prove true the theology that goes with that. that this history of Israel was the history that God chose, you know, that these were the chosen people, the bearer of the messianic promise, you know, leading up to the coming of Messiah. How do you prove that? You know, there is no way of proving that, at least in any scientific sense. You believe it or you don't. And of course it's helpful in a way, indeed, to know that some of the raw materials there actually happened, but still, you know, the actual proof of the meaning of it that we base our Christian faith on, that's, you know, beyond a proof. The Holy Spirit has to convince us of that. Otherwise, it's the case, you know, convince a fool against his will, he's of the same opinion still, if the Holy Spirit isn't there. So, you know, there are just a lot of things with that kind of talk that I think we have to be careful about. So the real value of archaeology, I think, is not so much to prove the Bible as to help us understand it. And of course, if you believe that it is God's word, then of course it'll help that much more. If you don't believe it's God's word, well, you know, all the extra understanding isn't going to help you all that much either until that changes. And I think then to help us understand, you know, one picture is worth a thousand words, of all these exhibits, you know, all around the room here, these reconstructions that are largely based on what we've discovered from archaeology. We'll talk about a few of them in a second. And of course, all the pictures that appear in books then, or something like, you know, this sling stone that we have, you know, just 101 things that it helps us understand all the way through. Now, one should subdivide this a little bit. There are two ways in which we use that word archaeology. In the strict sense, archaeology has nothing to do but just talks only about what came up out of the dirt, you know, like broken pieces of pottery, like that. And it doesn't tell us much more than that, and stubs of walls and the like. That's really the strict sense of archaeology. But I think in the broad sense in which we often use it, we think especially of the tablets, of the literature that's uncovered, that has told us so much then about the history and the religion of those times, that indeed we wouldn't have known if it hadn't been dug up by the archaeologists. But in a certain sense, once the archaeologist digs it up and then washes it off, then of course if it's a tablet with something written on it, well, then he passes it on to someone else, who in the strict sense is not an archaeologist anymore, who studies it and reads it, you know, and explains it in the light of all that we know. So you know, maybe we don't have to slice the cake that thin here tonight, but in a way we should keep those a little bit separate tonight. I'm not going to worry that much about keeping them separate, but some people feel rather strongly about that. If I talk about writing or literature that archaeologists have turned up, again, we have hardly any of that from Palestine itself. All of this partly tells us what a poor country Palestine was, relatively speaking. It never became a great, rich empire, you know, that could bleed off the taxes of the subjugated peoples like the Egyptians could do, or like the Babylon and Assyria did. And so that's reflected in the little bit of writing that has been preserved from Palestine. One of the exceptions, just to mention a couple of them, are the so-called Gezer calendar, who recalls from last time where on the map of Palestine Gezer or Gezer is. One, I should give you a test from the last time. Gezer is one of those places that's just down the hills from Jerusalem at the beginning of the Shephelah, or the foothills there. And in the early excavations there, turned up a little, it looks like a schoolboy's exercise. In this month, the farmer, you know, plows his field. In the next month, why, you know, he does this. In the next month, why, he harvests this grain. In the next month, you know, he harvests that, and so on, you know, through the whole calendar. And well, you know, that tells us a lot about the writing of that time, and the words they used, the names they had for the months, and all that type of thing. But that's short, you know, and that isn't all that much. But of course, we're grateful for the little bit that we do have. Or one other thing that should be mentioned that's rather famous are the so-called Lachish letters. Lachish is another town that's down in the foothills here to the southwest of Jerusalem, and guarding the approaches from Egypt. And in the guard room of the main gate of the city, in the little side rooms of the gate, there were found when they excavated that some of these letters that had been sent back to Lachish by contingents of the army that were, you know, further out in the outskirts, watching whether the enemy was coming and you know, giving them intelligence and information. And of course, this is especially interesting because Lachish fell just a short time before Jerusalem fell in 587, before Nebuchadnezzar captured it. And in Jeremiah 34, remember Jeremiah is the prophet that lives through all of this, in Jeremiah 34, Jeremiah mentions that at one point, only two cities were still standing besides Jerusalem, namely Lachish and Azekah, another city some 4 or 5 miles north. In one of the Lachish letters, we have the desperate report sent back to Lachish that we can no longer see the smoke signals of Azekah. You know, that in effect Azekah had just fallen then, apparently. So, you know, here's something that we can, you know, date, you know, within a day or maybe hours, you know, after that chapter of Jeremiah was written. It isn't very often that you can tune in that precisely. But in general, these letters, you know, then they're brief, they aren't a lot, but they tell us a little bit of what went on at that time and about the language and all of that kind of thing. Just one other inscription that I want to talk about from Palestine that's famous is the Hezekiah Tunnel inscription. Hezekiah living, well, a little over a century before Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians, when the Assyrians were threatening Jerusalem at that time. Hezekiah was concerned about his water supply, and the main water supply of Jerusalem at that time was outside the walls, and so very vulnerable, and that meant, of course, the enemy, if he could capture the water supply, of course, could force surrender in short order. And so King Hezekiah closed up the outside entrance to that spring, its water supply, and he dug a tunnel underneath the mountain or the peninsula that Jerusalem sat on, to the other side of the peninsula, where there was a reservoir into which the water could flow, that of course being inside the city walls then was easily defensible. But at that time, of course, to dig through this solid rock underneath the city, particularly with their engineering abilities at that time, well, it was quite a feat. And today you can wade through it. I don't know, have any of you been to Jerusalem? If you have, that's still one of those musts for anyone who's up to it today. During the rainy season, why, it gets pretty high. But during the summer, why, the water gets relatively low. I remember one time when I was through it, I'd been through it 3 times. But once I was through it with my boy, who at that time was a little younger, and at the deepest part, why, the water was just coming up to his chin, and he was beginning to have second thoughts about all of this. He'd been pretty brave about it all until then. But fortunately, then the water got a little shallower, and we went through the rest of it without too much trouble. But you can walk all the way through it today. Of course, you need a flashlight and a lag, and you can see, of course, the pick marks and everything in the rock very well. But at the end of this tunnel, a plaque was chiseled into the rock there, celebrating the achievement, and basically telling the story of how when the diggers who dug from both ends, when they got close, they could hear, you know, the people digging on the other side, and finally how they broke through, and how they were off just a little bit, considering, you know, this is really phenomenal that they met each other at all. But you can still see in the middle where they met and the little jog that there is there, you know, as they lined it up. But, you know, this is very interesting, and this is probably mentioned in passing in the Bible, Hezekiah's tunnel. But again, there's a little highlight and the language of that time and so on. But we have, on the whole, relatively little of that kind of thing from the Bible itself. But now from outside of Palestine, we have all kinds of important written materials, and it still comes in, and they tell us an awful lot about the Bible. One of the most important ones has the modern Arabic name of Rosh Shamra. That's, you know, not meaningful as such. Rosh Shamra means a cape or a head or something. Shamra is fennel, you know, it's a spice. They just gave it that name, I guess, because fennel was growing on this mound. Or the ancient name for it that you'll often meet in books about archaeology or about the Bible now too is Ugarit. And then of course we talk about Ugaritic, the Ugaritic language or the Ugaritic religion or the Ugaritic culture or so on. Where Ugarit was really northern Phoenicia. If you just follow the coastline of Palestine all the way up to where you remember Turkey today, just south, just before you get to where modern Turkey is, way up there in the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean is where Ugarit was, right on the seacoast. And Ugarit was destroyed shortly before 1200 BC by guess who? People we talked about last time. The Philistines again, or, you know, some of that same movement that I remember came down from the Black Sea area or the like and destroyed the Hittites in what today is Turkey. And Ugarit was in their way, and so of course that was completely obliterated, and of course on down. And it had never been touched until modern times, so we can be sure, you know, about the date of all of this. And this was discovered accidentally in 1929 by a farmer who plowed just a little bit too deep once and opened up a tomb. Of course that was investigated, and one thing led to another. And of course, pretty soon, why, that was put permanently out of cultivation of them. It's an immense site, and still probably only a third of it has been dug. In fact, I, you know, maybe here one should mention that in Palestine, of the ancient sites that we know that have been identified, and probably many we haven't even stumbled onto yet, we have only scratched the surface today. We know they're there, but, you know, it takes a lot of money and everything, and really, we haven't begun the fight on this front at all. But since then, why, there have been excavations going on almost every summer, except, you know, when wars interfere a little bit, as last summer, up there. But the finds here have just been phenomenal in their library. Basically, the whole religion of Canaan, of all that the Bible refers to about Baal and Asherah and these goddesses, and we want to talk about them next time when we turn to the mythology of the Near East. They're mentioned all over the place in the Bible, but the prophets don't tell us much about that. They weren't interested in doing that, and of course their people knew all about that only too well. They didn't have to explain that to them. They just, you know, polemicized against it. But now, you know, we have the other side of the story, of many of the actual stories of the gods, much as we know from Greece and Rome, and many other texts from the temple library of Ugarit that can hardly be overstated in terms of the importance of this for biblical studies in many ways. One other one that I want to mention, that if you read commentaries or the like, is a site by the name of Mari. This is a site, I still don't know what happened to my good map. This is
Could that be it down the shore there?
Could be.
No, that's Journey of St. Paul.
But if you remember, just let me try to sketch it out a little bit. You know, if this is the Eastern Mediterranean with Palestine here. Well, you remember the Euphrates, you know, basically goes down here, and the Tigris comes down and joins it down here in the Persian Gulf, if you can use your imagination with those chicken scratches enough. And Mari is a site over here on the Euphrates River. If you know today's map at all, it's in eastern Syria, just before you cross the border into Iraq, in that area. But the importance of Mari is that this is what we know as an Amorite site that has given us all kinds of parallels for understanding the way the patriarchs did things. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they had customs of their own. Many of the stories about, remember, Abraham with his concubine Hagar, and with her child Ishmael, and all the stories in connection with that. Or Jacob and Laban, when Jacob, you know, goes up there and works, you know, 7 years for one wife and gets tricked, and, you know, all the other stories bound up with that. Forgetting the whole background, you know, that that's not the way the Israelites did things, you know, later on. The patriarchs are earlier, and they had somewhat their own customs and the like. And so at least if you turn to commentaries on Genesis today, why, Amari has been one of the major sources for illuminating the laws and the customs and so on of patriarchal times. So that's very important. Let me mention thirdly a name, of course, that you know very well from the Bible, namely Nineveh. Site, of course, to which Jonah eventually went, and mentioned many other times, one of the main capitals of Assyria. But what concerns us is that very early on in the history of archaeology, over a century ago now, why, Layard was his name in digging here, discovered the library again of one of the last and greatest of the Assyrian kings, the name of Ashurbanipal. And of course, in a library like that, why, again, we're just, you know, we didn't even know the language of that part of the world before. And of course, there were people, again, skeptics, who doubted that many of the stories in the Bible about the Assyrians invading Jerusalem and so on, you know, weren't true and the like. So especially from Nineveh, why, that, you know, well over a century ago already now, just opened up that whole world of Babylon and Assyria that are mentioned so often in the Bible at that time. And of course, since that time, there have been many other discoveries from that part of the world filling in a little bit, but this still remains one of the most important ones. Let me mention one final name here. And one that that is still in the news, and maybe some of you saw it on the front page of the papers here only, 2 weeks ago, when the Biblical Society met here in St. Louis. And there was a major lecture downtown in that connection. And at least if you follow this stuff at all, you're going to hear a lot more about this name in the future. A place by the name of Ebla. It's in northern Syria. It's, again, if you would just follow this map up on the east side of the mountains rather than on the coast. Ugarit, as I said, is, you know, basically a seaport, while Ebla is inland. But it's basically, up about here, pretty well straight north of Palestine, but inland somewhat. Until very recently, we knew from other ancient finds that there was a place, you know, by this name around, but that's about all we knew about them. And here, all of a sudden, having discovered what in effect was their library again, someone compared this find all of a sudden discovering the Roman Empire in the history of the West. And if you know any history of Europe at all, why, you know, how do you talk about the history of Europe without the Roman Empire? But that's just about what it was in this period. And the date of this is so early. The date of Ebla basically is around 2300 B.C. That is some 500 years or so before Abraham. Very early. And there was a huge empire, you know, from here that controlled, you know, much of that whole area at that time. And so our history of all of this is just going to have to be totally rewritten now. And of course, we've just, you know, this has just been discovered. And of course, it leaves anyone who works in this field just about breathless, of course, to imagine what's all involved. But just as a couple of examples of this, it mentions, for example, as cities with which Ebla had trade relations, Sodom and Gomorrah. And Zoar, a third little town that's mentioned in connection with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that again, until recently, most critics have, you know, dismissed as, you know, a great, nice story. Doubtful if there ever were such cities. And indeed, something like this, you know, doesn't prove that story in the Bible as such, but it certainly does demonstrate that there were cities like that. And of course, long before the time of Abraham, Jerusalem is mentioned, by far the earliest mention that we have of the city of Jerusalem, and many other major cities. A man by the name of Eber was one of the main kings of Ebla. Does anyone know who Eber is in the Bible? In the Table of Nations in Genesis 10 and 11? If you put an H in front of it, well, you might guess. Well, I'll just change a couple of letters there, and you get Hebrew. Hebrew. Just, you know, just juggle things around a little bit. That happens a lot with ancient languages. But Genesis 10 mentions that Eber, you know, was one of their ancestors who gave them, you know, that name of Hebrew. And until this discovery, why scholars as critics, liberals, were almost unanimous in their belief. You know, this was just fiction, you know, they just kind of projected backward, you know, their name Hebrew and invented a name out of that, but that there, you know, wasn't any truth to that. And so here again, at least we know that this was a very common name of a great king of Ebla, and long before at least the biblical Hebrews were there. And maybe even the name of God in the Bible, Yahweh or Jehovah, is mentioned at this time. There are still a few questions about that. But many higher critics had believed that the Israelites in the evolution of their religion didn't even know the name Yahweh until the time of Moses or later. At any rate, if we have that name from this early, why, you know, that just puts an entirely different light on it. So I don't know an awful lot about this myself, but I think this, you know, just gives you an idea of the kind of things that are going on here. Well, now, I think in the time that remains before the break, I think I just want to talk a little bit about what goes on in an archaeological dig, as much as we can, as much as I can explain here, and you may well have questions on this here. As I said, in Palestine, you hardly ever have cities or pyramids or that type of thing left above the ground. Nearly always, all that you have is something that is called a tell. Remember, I talked about that last time. This is the Arab name for an artificial mound. Not a mound, of course, that, you know, is there from creation, but an artificial deposit from human habitation. And tells nearly always have a shape, something like this, with sloping sides, flat on the top, sometimes looking a little bit like the cone of an extinct volcano, a little bit, although usually not quite that steep. Asides. And how were these formed, these tells? There was, for one thing, how can you tell whether this is really the remains of an ancient city or whether it's just a natural formation? Well, generally, just take a walk over it and see if you find any pottery like that. You know, if people have never lived there, why, of course, they won't have left their tracks. But if they have, you can be sure that there will be, you know, remains of that, like, of course, so any place where people have lived today. It's almost a surefire way of at least telling whether you have something worth digging or not. And how were these formed? Well, basically, they were formed in layers by, you know, the first city that was there lived basically on ground level, wherever that was. And when that was destroyed or so on, why, you know, when the next inhabitants came, as I said before, this would simply be leveled off. But, you see, there would be the remains of the walls and so on from ancient times. That'd be one level. In addition, of course, this level was pretty high because people in antiquity, like most of the Orient today still, never heard of anything like a garbage collection. If you've ever been in southern Italy, or Beirut, or much of the Orient today, most of the garbage just gets pitched out of the window. You just better watch as you walk around in the back alleys of the city, at least. And, you know, eventually, if the pigs don't eat it first, why, you know, it just decays, and then the dirt builds up over the years. You can still see this a lot of times in the Middle East, where the street is much higher than the than the houses, where you have to walk down into the houses just because of the accumulation of this debris over the years. You know, for Westerners, for whom we think cleanliness is next to godliness, why, that's a strange idea, but, you know, east is east and west is west, as the saying goes, and there the twain shall meet. But anyway, it's those two things that account for the accumulation, the garbage and the ruins of a destruction. And then some people would rebuild, you know, and you'd have another layer. And, you know, how many were there in a site? This varies from place to place. Once in a while, of course, you'll only have one occupation, and that will hardly leave a rise at all, so much so that you may not even see it. It's, you know, it's so gentle as it's growing up then with weeds or trees or whatnot. Others of these, particularly some of those in Mediterranean that have been occupied consistently over the centuries, some of them are over 100 feet high above virgin soil. And of course, you can see them, at least if the area, if the terrain is level, you can see them for miles off. Around Jericho and then in the flat in the lower Jordan Valley, you can stand there and you can see more tells on the horizon than you can even count virtually. Or northern Syria is that way, in the vicinity of Ebla, or Haran too, where Abraham lived. There are just tells all over that flat tableland up there. And you know, this will vary a lot. Sometimes they'd be settled, and then, for who knows what reason, they wouldn't be settled for hundreds of years. You know, a lot of things go into that. And then, you know, somebody would decide there to live there again and would build it up. So the circumstances vary a lot, but basically this is the situation. Now, what gives them this sloping shape, and that what kept them from being eroded away by the rains over the centuries, is that basically you have here the stubs of the walls, especially the city walls. And of course, the next occupation, you know, would have to, you know, move in just a little bit in order to build there. But then you still have those, you know, just under the surface, or often, you know, right at the surface. But in effect, you know, that holds the grass and so on, and has prevented, you know, basic erosion over the centuries. So that, you know, they stood throughout the years. And of course, at the top, why, wherever they stopped the building for the last time, why that was the top. So of course, when you dig, why, you basically just reverse that history. You dig down, you know, people often compare it to peeling off the layers of an onion, you know, and just going down to however many there are. And of course, we call these different levels of occupation strata. And so one of the basic principles of archaeology, if you know that, why it's not as big a word as it looks like, is simply stratigraphy. It's simply watching very carefully your strata by street levels. And of course, here one gets into the technicalities of archaeology that finally one just has to learn by getting his hands dirty and spending some time at it, well, like anything. But the idea in principle is very, very simple, just to watch the strata and keep them separate. Initially, they're usually just numbered, you know, strata 1, strata 2, you know, going down. The higher the number, the earlier it is, of course, as you start counting from the top. How do you know what date this all is? Well, here, basically, the other main principle of archaeology that goes with stratigraphy has the name of typology. Of course, typology is applied to a lot of things, to a lot of sciences in different contexts. But as it's used in archaeology, you know, it's the study of types. And types of what? Basically, types of pottery. The shapes. Basically by studying the type of rim they have. And they're all types. Or the types of bases that they have. And they're all types. Here's one, of course, that has a nice little bottom. Others have little button bases that have, you know, have some holder or some depression in the ground to hold them up. They're all kind of handles they have, and there are all kinds of handles. You know, here's obviously a different type of a handle than that, you know, just to indicate. All those types of things. A little bit the kind of decoration you have. But again, you know, you've all seen pictures of these pretty vases from Greece with pretty pictures on them and so on. Again, Palestine is just too poor a country. Like many poor people today, they're happy if they have, you know, some dishes to eat off of and something to put on. They don't have money for any expensive china. And that was generally, you know, the case with Palestine. So you have very little pottery with any painting or decoration on it. But a little bit of it has this, you know, this is called ribbon. I mean, this is a sure sign of a Byzantine pottery after the time of Christ. It's just the one modern. But in earlier times, it has, you know, different types of a, it was a type of a burnish,